Hi, and welcome to the Enthusiastcast, the web show where we always recommend an awesome book. He's John, I'm Mark, and this episode I'm going to be enthusiastic about Brendan Koerner's The Skies Belong to Us. But first, it's 2014, we haven't recorded in a long, long while, and there's some housekeeping to do. So, John, looking back on 2013, what's the one reading experience that stood out for you, positive or negative?
Well, when I looked back on 2013, I guess, you know, we were on sort of an informal hiatus, unplanned hiatus, and I got super lazy with my reading. We'd done the show for about 3 years, and as you know, for the show, we were constantly looking like, okay, well, what's the next book, right? We need to try new things. We need to try new authors. We need to try new genres. So we ended up on this hiatus. And I was like, well, it's just going to be literary mac and cheese for me. I'm going to have, you know, I'm going to read the authors, new books by authors that I love. I'm going to read series books, which maybe I've been putting off because, you know, who wants to hear me be enthusiastic about part two of a book series where I was enthusiastic about part one? That's not going to make for a good show. And what I discovered having that year was a couple of things. One, I got less out of the books. It almost feels like reading is kind of a sport where you have to practice, you know, and you have to apply yourself. And the more you do, the more you get out of it. It seems obvious, but there it is. And the other thing that I really noticed, my biggest takeaway that I think is going to inform how I read going forward was, and this, it feels unfair, but it was a bit of diminishing returns with new books by authors whose books I had liked previously. You know, I got very excited about maybe half a dozen to 10 books that came out in 2013 that were new books by authors, most of which that I had been enthusiastic about before. And it's not that all of those books were universally bad, but I just didn't, most of them did not have the pop and the sizzle that I had gotten from the book that had initially gotten me interested in that author in the first place. What I found was that the batting average was much higher when I went to new authors, not necessarily even, you know, new genres or new types of stories, but new authors. And the one exception to this rule would be series books. So either, you know, trilogies or just character series books, where rather than it being diminishing returns, it just sort of felt like I was reading the next chapter in a longer work. So they, you know, it kind of got around that, you know, second verse, same as the first, but worst. So that, you know, basically that's where I'm at coming out of 2013 is it's time to buckle down. It's time to look for the new thing. And I feel bad that, I mean, this means that I'm not, and we, I think I've talked about this on a previous show. I'm not going to be locked into authors in the way that I was in the past. I don't think that, you know, finding 10 or 20 or even 30 authors who I really dig on and then just reading their output from now until the end of time is what's going to give me the most satisfaction as a reader. Now, that's bad news for those authors who have mortgages and, you know, just want to have that kind of that locked in, that thousand fans, right, who are just going to support them in perpetuity. But I think that, you know, going out and finding the new is what's going to make me happiest as a reader.
So what was your one? What was the one?
What was the one? Probably the biggest pop for me this year actually was, I've mentioned this to a bunch of people, and it's kids' books, really. It's the Skullduggery Pleasant series by Derek Landy.
Oh, no way.
I think I've talked to you about
no,
that.
No, you haven't.
Well, I think pound for pound, that gave me the most pleasure because it's a 9-book series, right? And then there's a spin-off book, and then there was a novella that came out for World Free Book Day. And it's weird because on the face of it, it is utterly a Harry Potter knockoff in the sense that, so it's a 9-book series. It starts out, the first book is written at the level that you could easily hand it to a 10-year-old. The character, the main character, is very young in the first book. And as each book goes along, gets older and older and older into like late teens, early adulthood. And then the content gets more sophisticated with each book. So in that way, very much like the Harry Potter books, it is middle grade to young adult fantasy fiction about a world where, you know, magic is real. The young protagonist finds out that they are a part of this world they didn't know before. Like, it is, the similarities are astounding. But what I really enjoyed about it was that where the Harry Potter books, sort of the deeper thematic concerns were largely with race and racism, the concerns of the Skullduggery Pleasant books are largely to do with the exercises, uses, and abuses of power. So basically, you know, if the good guys are also hitting the people that they don't agree with, what separates that? What separates them from the bad guys? And are terms like good and bad even really applicable or functional in the world? So it has that greater subtext. The writing is really sharp and funny. It has a, I would say, almost a Douglas Adams type of wit, which works for not everybody, but works for me. And so
I had no idea that you were into him. Would that series be appealing to girls in the same way that Harry Potter was appealing to girls, though?
I would like to think so. He's a male writer, obviously, but the main character, is Valkyrie Kane, is a girl.
Oh, all right.
So it basically, if you're a girl and you're listening to the show and you want to read a sort of YA fantasy series that's largely about a girl beating the living fuck out of people for hundreds and hundreds of pages, then this is for you.
Yeah, bullying. Okay.
Well, it gets in, basically, it's a sort of like, you know, you...
Well, yeah.
It gets into that, right? Like, is that cool? Like, are all superheroes really just bullies? They're people who woke up one day and had fantastic powers and basically said, yes, I'm going to go and impose my will on the world through violence, and why do we think that makes them good?
So it's funny, without doing the show, like, I'm in the exact opposite place as you. I haven't had a measured reading schedule at all, and I've been doing, like, binge purge segments all year. And it's funny, because without doing the show, I have no history. So going back and being like, what did I read in January? I have no idea. So in thinking about the best of 13, I'm really just thinking about the last 3 months.
Right.
And so I basically went to when the best of list started coming out in like November-ish or whatever. I was just, you know, I had the time and I was in the right place, and I just started picking titles off kind of the best of list. And I basically went on a crazy reading splurge for December. So I'm all about binge reading, and I'm thinking 2014, I need to do more binge reading. I have gotten away from like finding one author and going deep with them. And I was saying this to someone the other day, and they were just like, oh, binge reading's the worst. And I was like, no, I miss it from like, you know, I'm all nostalgic from when I was in grade school or whatever and doing binge reading. And I was like, oh, I want to recapture the magic. So I don't know. So I caught up with Zuzak's The Book Thief.
Oh, hey, that's one of my recommendations from the very beginning.
Like, I know. It's one of your favorites. And I don't know if we've talked about that. And then on the fiction side also, Christopher Priest, The Adjacent. That was on the Guardian Top 10 Sci-Fi of the Year list.
Yeah, and now Christopher Priest, he wrote The Prestige, right?
He did, yeah. And so I had not read him before, but I had seen that movie.
Which is a great movie.
And, you know, I guess he's into, like, doubles and twins and stuff like that. And from The Adjacent, I don't know if it's entirely clear, but it covers the same territory. So a lot of people who are familiar with him, it's just like, oh, yeah. But it was completely new to me. Blew me away. I loved it. And then, well, it's like also fans of Caron's Children of Men.
Okay.
Really, really reminded me of that. And so I went and I researched the movie, and I didn't realize that the Children of Men movie was quite a departure from the book.
Okay.
So that world that is that film world, that alternate history, that English alternate history thing is very much reminiscent of the adjacent. So if you're into that kind of thing, then I two thumbs up for Christopher Priest's new one. And then on the nonfiction side, I read Brad Stone's The Everything Store. It's probably the best business book I've read in a long time.
Okay.
You know, for those who read the Steve Jobs bio, not everybody out there, obviously, but if
a lot of people bought the Steve Jobs bio, I don't know that a lot of people read the Steve Jobs bio.
If you're one of those people that were disappointed by the Steve Jobs bio, like I was, the Everything Store is a nice remedy. It gives insight into the man, Bezos, and into the company Amazon in a way that you wouldn't. That I thought was really thoughtful. And then on the really obscure side, this is like a deep Christmas recommendation, but for those people that are fans of the histories of particular like eras or years, and I guess I'm thinking of like Margaret Macmillan's Paris 1919.
Okay.
Which, again, isn't for everyone, but she's got a follow-up now about 1914. So if that's your thing, then I would recommend Ian Buruma's Year Zero, which is about 1945. It's a really chatty, thoughtful history. Really chatty, interesting history of 1945, January 1st to December 31st. And he just talks about everything that went on, like, month by month, week by week. It's really... It was on the New York Times 100 Best Of. So I picked it off there, and I just got into it and really grooved on it. Both are pretty niche,
right?
So if that's not your bag, then that's not your bag. But
see, and I was totally I've read the Book Thief, the Christopher Priest. I've been dancing around reading Christopher Priest for a long time, and that's always when I'm sort of like, what am I going to read? What am I going to read? That's a name that always comes up. It's like, oh, I wonder if he's got anything. So absolutely, I might check that out. I should also mention that I read Gone Girl. Which was like the big word of mouth. Did you read that?
Yeah.
And I liked it. I know that a lot of people didn't ultimately came away from that book not liking it or unhappy with it. And I found that it was one of those books that I liked more and more the more I thought about it. A lot of books get that warm glow, which lasts about a week to 2 weeks, and then it starts to slowly fade over time. And that was a book that I actually enjoyed more and more the longer it took, the more I thought about it. And now, of course, she's adapted it. Gillian Flynn, the author, has adapted it. She's written the screenplay for the movie, which is being done by Fincher, starring Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. And she's apparently completely changed the third act.
Ah!
Yeah. Apparently everybody got the script and was like, wait a minute, she like threw out the entire third act and rewrote it. So if you didn't like it the first time around, maybe you're really going to love the movie, or maybe this will be a chance for you to hate it again. I'm kind of curious because I dug it the first time around. I don't know why, because it's not my usual cup of tea in that the characters are a lot unlikable a lot of the time. And I like my warm and fuzzy protagonist that I can really get behind. But that book worked for me for whatever, I guess because it surprised me and I felt like it was playing fair. I didn't like it 100%. There were pieces of it that I felt were a bit contrived, particularly, the man that she goes to.
Bit
there, right? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If you've read the book, you know what I'm talking about. That bit felt contrived to me, but a lot of the other stuff I felt was interesting and unexpected, but in a playfair kind of way.
Okay, so I guess we should also talk about Jenny Picoult's My Sister's Keeper. Way back, before a prolonged hiatus. We challenged each other to read beyond our usual niches.
Yes, we did.
And you challenged me to read Picot, and I challenged you to read Jeanette Winterson.
Jeanette Winterson's Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit.
Now, having read My Sister's Keeper, I will say, if I was still a bookseller, I could have easily seen myself picking this up to see what all the hype is about because, you know, she's a big deal and
yep.
all that.
Yes, she is.
But I suspect that oranges aren't the only fruit would have never come up in your to-be-read pile.
No.
Like, in all possible worlds, you probably never would have picked that up. So, positive or negative experience for you?
Positive or negative experience for me? You're right. In most of the universes in which I exist, I go to my grave never having read that book. And having read it, I feel like alternate universe me was justified in that decision. He knew he knew his own mind. He knew his likes. He knew his dislikes. And, you know, he was fine to have read other things instead of that book. That said, it's a good book, and I can see why it has its fans, and it does what it sets out to do very well. Just what it sets out to do is not something that I'm going to pick up for pleasure. To give the background on the book, it's a Bildungsroman. It's a semi-autobiographical coming of age story by Jeanette Winterson about the character, quote unquote, Jeanette, who is adopted and raised by an incredibly religious family in the UK in the 60s, 70s. And she's particularly her adoptive mother is incredibly, incredibly religious. And so she's kind of in this bubble where she's being everything that she is taught comes directly from the Bible. And she's being taught that she's, you know, going to change the world and be a missionary. And as she gets older, she begins to suspect that what she's being told is not, you know, the whole of reality, and that perhaps what she's being told about herself doesn't really jive with who she actually is. Part of who she actually is lesbian. So obviously that's a point of conflict right away, and some other things. And it's interesting. It had two effects on me. One was, so this was published in the mid 80s, was adapted into a movie, a BBC film in like 89. And it reminded me very much of my university experience, right? Of the people that I knew then, the people in the English and the writing programs, and that earnestness, that sense of self-exploration, of self-discovery. And at the same time, because we are now so removed by time from that experience, you know, when I go to McDonald's for lunch now, I walk in the door and the Indigo Girls are playing. And that's what the passage has time has done. It has sort of taken those experiences, which were so earnest and heartfelt, and it's removed the emotion, and then it's repackaged them. And so reading the book reminded me of that, and it reminded me of that feeling of the world changing around you, and basically questioning everything that you thought that you knew about the world, and making up your new reality, because part of what the book is about is how, you know, any story, a story that we tell ourselves is inherently fictional, even if it's a story of true events. And so we are making up the world for ourselves, and her parents, particularly her mother, were making up the world for her, and she had to find a way to break out of that. And so
you're a teenage girl, and it's like, everything is life or death, right?
Yeah, and I think it works. It works beyond gender, but I wasn't sure. You know, where I came to it was it generational, or is it something that every generation goes through? Because I feel now like the earnest experiences of my youth have now basically been sort of packaged and sold and incorporated into the fabric of everyday life.
Right.
And But at the same time, I remember being younger and hearing older people or reading articles by older people talking about how their experiences growing up in the 60s were now being used to sell, you know, cars. And so
I got you. Yeah. Okay.
I'm just wondering, is my experience now of going back and reading this book that is from the 80s that reminds me of being young, of having those experiences, rather than having feelings of identification, I'm having feelings of wistfulness. I'm having feelings of nostalgia. And I'm wondering, is that unique to that experience, or is that the experience that any middle-aged person would have reading about the experiences of a young person?
I didn't really think that it was a novel of the 80s in that way. But that's interesting.
It's not. I mean, it's also odd in the sense that, so it deals with the notion of, you know, there's a constructed reality and you can get beyond that constructed reality and construct a new reality for yourself. And obviously it's semi-autobiographical, so Winterson is speaking out of her own experiences, which are what they are, but because the reality that's created for her by her mother is so niche, it is not the mainstream view. It would be one thing if she was living within the mainstream and she was talking about trying to redefine herself outside of the mainstream, but she's actually coming at it from the other angle. She's in this weird little cul-de-sac where even like all of her teachers, all of her peers at school, everybody in the village looks at her and her family and goes, "You guys are oddballs. You're
they're really cloistered, religious."
Absolutely.
Right.
Right. Okay. They're very different even from their community. So,
and she's like homeschooled, right?
Yes. The turning point comes when she's forced to go to public school.
Oh.
Right? Like the government comes in and says, "You know, you got to send this kid to regular school.
Can't just be learning about the Bible."
Yeah. And that's where the conflict starts, right? As she begins to suspect things. So the normal story would be a young person who's homosexual and their homosexuality pulls them away from the mainstream, or sort of keeps them at a remove from the mainstream. And this is actually a story where her homosexuality is one of the key points which moves her away from her non-traditional lifestyle and towards a form of the mainstream, or at least a different non-traditional lifestyle. So it's odd in that regard.
Huh.
But
why is it called the oranges aren't the only fruit?
Whenever she's not feeling, whenever she has any stress in her life, her mother gives her oranges, as if oranges were the only fruit. And so it's a metaphor for, you know what, there's a lot of different stuff in the world.
I see. Did we talk about Picot when we talked about Never Let Me Go?
I don't know if we did. Because I don't think neither one of us had read My Sister's Keeper at that time. The only time I remember us talking about Picot was in relation to Franzen.
Right. Okay. So, So what do I have to say about My Sister's Keeper? I guess, first of all,
what can you say about the book without giving too much?
Well, first of all, having read it now, I get what the fuss is about with her. Like, I get why she's a big deal.
All right.
And I kind of had it in my head that she was kind of a James Patterson level novelist.
Oh, okay.
But she's actually way better than that.
That's, yes.
Like, on a completely different tier of betterness. And so that was like, oh, holy crap, okay. You know, and this is why she's the thing that she is, right?
It's always nice, though, that when you find out somebody that's popular to that degree is also
talented.
Is also talented and is not just pandering to.
Second thing, I guess I can also see why she's contentious, why she's got the haters.
Right.
Right. You know, on a credibility level, in this book anyway, she kind of challenges the notion, challenges some of the assumptions around parenting.
Right.
And so on that level, kind of the emotional manipulation is kind of transparent.
Okay.
So I feel that if that got up your nose at all, then you could easily walk away.
Right.
Right. the reminded of Nicholas Sparks, reminded of Paul Haggis, where it's just like, okay, you know, I've signed up for this.
You either, right, you either accept the conceit or you don't.
Right. And that stuff's not for everybody. So I can, you know, I can see. In the end, I guess I was pleasantly surprised. Again, if I was a bookseller, I would easily recommend this. Probably 10 years too late, but I'd easily recommend this to any book club people that walked in the door.
Okay, so, okay.
And say...
So specifically book club, why? Because there's a lot of meaty stuff to talk over?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, because of the conceit, right? So, right. So my Sister's Keeper, if you don't know, if you missed the movie, and if you have missed... the Picot phenomena or whatever is ideal family in America, have a son, have a daughter, that daughter turns out to have leukemia and a way of saving someone that has leukemia is to do like, stem cell and
bone marrow.
Bone marrow transplants or whatever, and so they end up having a third child via IVF, which they kind of genetically engineer to be a match for the second sister, and then that second daughter grows up to the age of about 8 or 9, I think, and then decides that she's not cool with being the donor child to her older sister. And so files a court case, goes and seeks out a lawyer and basically, endeavors to sue her parents for medical, emancipation, I guess is what it's called. And so she was never asked if she wanted to sign up to be this, this donor organ really, for older sister, which potentially puts her in jeopardy for, you know, having a normal childhood and growing up and having kids herself and all of that stuff. So it really, so the novel really centers on that conflict between what happens if, parents acting in, you know, in total best interests of the second child, you know, good intentions and all of that, end up, really compromising the interests of the third child. And so, so I think that like, through that very idea, it brings up a lot of stuff, right?
And does she do a decent job of shifting your sympathies around at various times so there's not a clear right and a clear wrong all the time?
She not only does a good job, but she it's probably even overkill, right? Like, she starts off in the voice of the third daughter and shifts to the mother, shifts to the father, shifts to the lawyer, and to the point where you're just like, okay, I got it. You know, I got it. But a lot there. I would recommend it. I'm now a little curious about the rest of her other 17 odd books. You know, I look at the covers and they're like all paisley and like flowery. And I'm just like, okay, this one has a bit of a, you know, ethical moral hook to it that hits above its weight. And I wonder if that's consistent with her other stuff, and that it's like it suckers you in with the expected and comfortable, and then like, you know, right hooks you above the belt, or if this is the one, because this is the one movie that has not been made into a movie of the week, has actually been made into a feature film,
right.
And so I wonder if this is the standout, and I don't know.
She had one, I can't remember the name of it, but the only other one where I know sort of the plot was about a school shooting, a Columbine-esque school shooting. And so it sounds like she could do a lot with that material, but maybe not movie material, but just because of the nature of the subject matter.
Huh. Yeah, and we need to talk about Kevin. Like, I thought of that, and I thought of... Ishiguro, and I was just like, oh, yeah. So anyway, you put it in my hands. I was like, I never would have picked this up.
But again, and alternate universe Mark goes to his grave.
And there was path. So I appreciate it.
Oh, cheers.
Anyway, and was nice because I am definitely grooving on, like, my own. Like, I even the pick today, I feel, you know, is a little... He was a little close to Unbroken, which is last episode. And it's like, yeah, we're going to get to be known as the nonfiction, you know...
Right,
nonfiction current events guy.
Well, so far, what have we covered today? We've covered sort of YA fantasy. We've covered the 1980s buildings roman. We've sort of a book clubbish novel. I feel like that's some good breadth.
Okay.
And this is different from all of those. So tell me about The Skies Belong to Us by Brendan Koerner.
Okay, so again, this is was on a few of the critics' best of lists of the year. I picked this up, like, so this blew up in maybe the summertime or the fall. Got a rave review in the New York Times. I think it was the front page of the book review. Got lots of attention then, and a friend recommended it. Said, yes, well worth your time. Seems like kind of my thing, so I was like, oh, yeah, I'll pick that up. Didn't, obviously, didn't at that time, and then when it started making the best of lists, I was like, okay, it's time. So I got it, and I'm just being enthusiastic about it today because it's just a lot of fun. It's just so much fun. So if you can imagine, like, Catch Me If You Can meets Dog Day Afternoon meets Bonnie and Clyde.
Okay.
Right? So it's just, So it's the story of how Vietnam vet Roger Holder and his, and this, like, hippie moonchild named Catherine Kirkow hijack a plane from Los Angeles to Seattle and end up on this, like, two-decade criminal odyssey.
Hijack a plane for the purposes of, because obviously in today's climate, when you hear hijack a plane, it doesn't sound like a romp.
Yeah. Yeah. So Koerner does this excellent job of expanding the story. So it's nonfiction. It's a true story. He had only limited access to the facts or whatever. So instead of, you know, an 8,000 word magazine piece, he blows it out and includes, the story's phenomenal and touches on all these areas anyway. So he just explores this stuff as it comes up, but it's against kind of the political upheaval backdrop of Vietnam and the race tension and stuff like that. Holder's white, Holder's black, Kirkow's white.
Okay.
And they're a couple. They have this intersection with the Black Panthers and the Weathermen, which are the kind of leftist terrorists of the time. There's this, like, jet setting element where they are living the high life, and I, you know, as a child of the 80s, remember the hijackings on the nightly news when I was growing up, being like a serious big effing deal,
right?
Mideast terrorism or whatever. And this is really the entree to that, because we hadn't got to the Chuck Norris terrorism hijackings yet.
Why did everything get shit in the 80s? Like, sex was awesome in the 70s, and then it got horrible and fatal in the 80s. Drugs were awesome in the 60s and 70s, and they got, like, horrible and dirty and epidemic in the 80s.
So
hijacking was great in the 70s.
So there's like 45 hijackings in the continental U.S. In the 70s, according to Wikipedia. I don't know. I didn't go back and look up what Koerner's numbers were, but I was just looking at Wikipedia today at, like, you know, hijackings of note from the 70s, and there was like 35 of them. But this is the age before metal detectors.
Right.
And you could basically get on an airplane like you would get on a bus today. You'd buy a ticket and you'd get on,
you
right?
You could smoke.
And you could smoke. And so Koerner, like, does an excellent job of you know, exploring both the hysteria, because, like with any mass phenomena, the press is all over it, right? And then once one person does it, it snowballs. So these guys end up asking for $500,000, right? And so, you know, at the in the beginning, it was like, yeah, can you just like take me to Cuba or whatever? And by the time that these guys show up, they're just like, okay, well, $500,000. And so it's like that goes down. But it's like this charming snapshot of kind of a naive America, but also, talks about how it's a big deal that, getting searched at the airport, and there was like Fourth Amendment, first constitutional, repercussions in Congress. And they had to wait until like the hysteria built up to a crazy amount before before Congress would be like, oh yeah, okay, civil liberties at the airport, out of the way, right? And that is a direct touchstone today, obviously.
Well, because I was, yeah, that's all I was thinking. So you say there was like 45 hijackings of note, and so I was wondering how that didn't lead to like crazy security at the airports, right? I mean, after the most recent hijackings, obviously it was like, please take off your socks and shoes, and isn't that a unusually large tube of toothpaste you have there, sir? And like, crazy town, right?
Is this the beginning?
This is the beginning. It's first steps.
Yeah, and as a reader familiar with that now, like through that lens, you're just like, holy crap, right? But essentially, these are like two kind of irresponsible love children in the 70s who get like sucked into this crazy vortex that's kind of unbelievable. And I don't want to ruin the end for you because, I'm sure if you read the back jacket of it, it somewhat ruins it. But Kerner's really deft at applying context and color in this way that just made it one of my best reads the last year. So The Skies is easily in my top five, and that's my pick for this week.
You know what this reminds me of? Is it called Mr. Nice? That book that we read way back in the day about that guy who was like the biggest pot dealer in the world for X number of years.
It's like Carlos and Carlos meets cocaine,
and I gotta say, there's a cynical part of me that sort of questions the charming rogue, the refined criminal, because I think that that's something that we all would like to believe in, right? And yet the people who do these things, you know, are they all that? And yet it is undeniably a trope that works, that is appealing, right? The people who they do these terrible criminal things, and yet, because they don't seem to have any malice in them, we are charmed by them stepping outside of the norm and doing things big, right?
You're definitely rooting for these two characters. Unlike Mr. Nice, however, which is an autobiography in quotations, this is third person, and there's the author does a good job of hemming that stuff in. So a lot of the source material, it's just like, you know, I was listening to the interview with Kerner, and the interviewer was just like, how the hell did you fact check this? Right? Like,
right.
You know, and he's like, well, I did my best because a lot of, 75% of it checked out. And so,
right.
So, you know, what's there, I think is there in a responsible way. Apparently he, you know, there was more hearsay and stuff that he left out, but I felt like I was in good hands, and I know that you were particularly aggravated by Mr. Nice's kind of louche criminality or whatever, and there's just desserts here, so it's just like,
well, and I think I, because you say like autobiography in quotes, I felt like there were places where I wasn't being told the whole truth, or things were being shaped to help me have that positive impression. And so it sounds like this sort of third person remove does that. without, you know, completely, you know, doing away with the whole reason that the story is interesting in the first place.
Right, right. Yeah, no, no, no. So I'd recommend this if it's probably going to be out in paperback by the time you hit your beach read. So if
you're not flying to the beach.
If you need, like, if you need something that you'd sit down and, like, nonfiction candy, kind of, it will perfectly hit the spot. You probably read it in two or three sittings. And the female protagonist is interesting too. So I think that, I think watch for it, come beach reading season. So that's it.
Awesome. So that's it for another episode of the Enthusiasticast. As always, you can leave a comment on the blog at enthusiasticast.com or contact us directly via our email, hello@enthusiasticast.com. We're always interested to hear from you, what you're reading, what you like, what you think maybe we should read. And we encourage you to leave a review in iTunes if you enjoy what we do, as that's a great way to help other people find the show. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.
Thank you. Very nice.